Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're used to the notion that ideas and information can spread from one person to another. But what about behaviors? That is the question that we will explore this morning in this hour of Focus as we talk with Nicholas Christakis. He is both an MD and a sociologist at Harvard, and we'll be looking at some of the research that he has done that suggests that behaviors, things like smoking, drinking, unhealthy eating, just to name three, can spread within social networks. We'll also try to talk about how understanding that process might be able to help us in shaping health behavior and also making health policy. Professor Christakis is visiting the campus. The psychology department brought him here. He gave a talk last night, and we're really pleased that he could be with us this morning. Just a little bit more about him. He's professor of sociology at Harvard, as well as professor of medical sociology and a professor of medicine at the Harvard Med School. And one more thing I want to mention, if you're interested in this subject, you might want to take a look at a book which he co-authored that was published in 2009. The title of the book is Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. Little Brown is the publisher, and it's a book that's intended for the general audience. You don't have to be a psychologist or a doctor to appreciate it. It's out there if you want to take a look at it. And questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, David.
I wonder if you could tell the story or talk a little bit about how it is you became interested in these questions, because I think it serves as a nice example of how it is in science. Sometimes you start looking at one thing or you're doing one thing and you end up looking at something else that you might not have expected.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm both a physician and a social scientist, and actually clinically I'm an internist, and in particular my specialty is hospice and palliative medicine. So I take care of people who are dying. And I was at the University of Chicago in the 1990s before I moved to Harvard about 10 years ago. And at the time, I was taking care of patients as part of a hospice program on the south side of Chicago. And I was observing in my clinical care how illness or death in one person might be causing or contributing to illness or death in other people to whom they were connected, their friends, their family members, and so forth. And in my lab at the time, I was studying something known as the widower effect, which is the increased probability of the recently bereaved to die. So that when my wife dies, my risk of death approximately doubles for the first 6 months after she dies and stays elevated for quite some time. So I had been looking at the widower effect, and one day I went to visit a woman who was an old woman dying of dementia, and she was not being cared for by her husband but rather by her daughter. And the daughter had become exhausted from the care that she'd been giving to her mother. And the daughter's husband had become sick from his wife's exhaustion. And I was driving home from that particular case, and my cell phone rings. It was an old-fashioned, it was like a brick then, cell phone. And it was the best friend of the husband. And he was depressed about what was happening to his friend. And I suddenly had this very basic observation, which is that the widower effect, first of all, wasn't restricted to pairs of husbands and wives. It could, of course, include other types of pairs of individuals like parents and children, as in this case. And second, it wasn't even restricted to pairs. I mean, here we have a kind of non-biological spread of disease, a kind of sociological spread from the mother to the daughter, from the daughter to the husband, from the husband to the friend, the little tetrad of people. And so as a result of this, I became interested in and aware of the extent to which we are all embedded in these enormous social networks. So each of us have these little dyadic, these pairwise relationships with other people who in turn have their own relationships. And as a result of that, we form these ornate, complex, frankly, beautiful structures that are known as social networks. And most people hearing this probably have seen pictures of social networks. They've become a part of pop culture now. But if they haven't, they can imagine a kind of mess of Christmas tree lights. So think about when you open the Christmas tree lights at the beginning of the year and you're going to put them on your tree, and they're all knotted together, and you kind of spread them out on the floor, and you've got a thick central knot, and then you've got these little tendrils that spread out. Each of the lights might be a person, and the wires connecting them would be the connections between the people, and you have this complex kind of interconnection pattern. That's what a social network looks like. Yeah. And that's what we've been studying for the last 10 years.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating notion that we have these things, social problems, health problems, things like obesity, which you have looked at, but you also might look at substance abuse, or you might look at other kinds of things, where to which we attach the word epidemic.
Yes.
We talk about there's as an epidemic of obesity.
Yes.
There's an epidemic of this, epidemic of that. And it, then so that interested you, and you said, well, let's say take something like obesity that we attach that word to. If you look at that, if you try to map out people who are unhealthy weight and their relationships with each other, can you see anything about the patterns and the spread that would be like you would see if you were talking about a communicable disease?
That's right. And that's what we were able to do. So we were able to, taking advantage of data that had been archived from the Framingham Heart Study, and since then many other data sets, map out the pattern of interactions that people have across time. In the Framingham Heart Study case, over 32 years, beginning in 1971, we know who's whose friend, who's whose spouse, who's whose neighbor, who's whose coworker, who's whose sibling and relative, and how those change across time. And also we had information about people's behaviors and body size and other attributes across time. And we were able to see, was there evidence for a kind of spreading process? Was obesity in this case, as you're alluding to, not just epidemic kind of metaphorically, but was it literally epidemic? Could we find evidence for a literal spread from person to person? And actually, what's interesting, not just from person to person, but also from person to person to person and person to person to person to person, because what's most interesting to us is not the claim that we affect the people to whom we are connected, because most people would accept that claim and it's almost commonsensical, although we were able to show it for some phenomena that aren't so commonsensical, for instance, body size. But what's especially interesting is to be able to document the extent to which we are affected by people to whom we're indirectly connected, strangers to us. So a person you don't even know that's your friend's friends or your friend's friend's friend might adopt a behavior or an idea or an emotional state, and that might ripple through the network and come and affect you. And interestingly, on the obesity thing, there's in the news today, there's a small study that was done. I haven't read it yet. I just read the news article about it, where someone looked at a surgeon, looked at bariatric surgery, and they looked at if they do major surgery on someone who's very, very overweight, very obese, to help them lose weight. Does it work? Okay, yes, it does. But does it also have ripple effects in their family? Do the family members of the person who's lost weight also go on and lose weight? And they were able to document that apparently it does. So there are these different sorts of ways that these ideas, I think, are beginning to seep into the culture and begin to affect how we think about healthcare delivery now, too, not just how we think about the nature of public health problems in our society.
Well, just to talk some more about obesity, I think one of the things that you found was if you took a look at people who were obese and their connections with other people, that you found that if you had somebody who was really close to you who was obese, that increased your risk of being obese. But the further out, a good friend of yours, a good friend of theirs,
that's right,
was really obese. Well, that the chances that you would be obese were lessened,
were reduced.
Somewhat.
That's right.
So as the people get further and further
Correct.
From you, your risk of being obese gets less and less. So it
that's
has,
right.
it's this closeness thing, which I guess would invite some more, you know, some more conventional explanations, because you do eventually have to get to the point where you ask the question, well, what's going on here?
Right.
Why is it happening? More conventional explanations of, well, yes, if, you know, say with smoking, why do kids start smoking? Because their friends do.
Mm-hmm.
And if none of their friends did and their parents didn't and nobody they knew did, the chances that one day they would just light one up, probably not very good.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you go about thinking about why this happens?
So just because one says that things spread in networks doesn't mean that they all spread in the same way. So the question you're asking now has to do with the mechanism of these phenomena. So for example, we would believe that, or we do believe, and it's known, we know that germs spread differently than emotions, which spread differently than money, which spread differently than behaviors, which spread differently than ideas. We might use the word spread for all of these phenomena. But the mechanism by which they spread is very different in all of those cases. And even within classes, some germs spread differently than other germs. Some spread by sexual contact. Some spread by, you know, through the air. And ideas might be the same way, or behaviors might be the same way. So, for instance, for behaviors, you can imagine that I copy your behavior for all kinds of different reasons. For instance, I observe my neighbors giving money to the United Way. Well, why does that action by my neighbor affect me? One possibility is that it's a simple information transmission. They tell me, oh, you have to do your paycheck and fill in this paperwork, and if you do that, then that's how you give. Another possibility is a kind of normative effect. I see, oh, the people around me are acting in this sort of pro-social way. Maybe I should do it. Another is simple mimicry. So people often copy other people sort of unconsciously or thoughtlessly, as it were. So there are different kinds of ways, different mechanisms we can begin to drill down. In the case of obesity, we believe a couple of mechanisms are at play. One kind of mechanism, why do I gain weight when my friends gain weight? And when my friends' friends gain weight, incidentally, when my friends' friends gain weight, it doesn't affect me magically. It affects me through the impact on my friends. Just like if my friends' friends have the flu and I don't know those people, the way I get the flu from them is that they infect my friend who then infects me. But given that, so there's a spreading process in the network in the case of obesity, how might it happen? Well, one possibility is that there's a spread of behaviors. So here the idea is that your friend says, you know, Nicholas or David, let's go have muffins and beer. And you say, I don't, you know, particularly like muffins and beer, but my friend is suggesting it, and you adopt this, you know, kind of silly eating behavior. Mm-hmm. Another possibility is that it's not a spread of behaviors from person to person, but rather a spread of norms or ideas. So here what happens is you gain weight, and it resets my idea about what an acceptable body size is. And then I, in turn, relax some way, gain weight, and then pass it along. And anyone who's looked at photographs of military recruits from the Second World War lining up, or even those lines that, you know, looked at, so those photographs from the 40s and 50s of all these people in hats walking down the street, those people look totally different than we do. They were much thinner than we are. And I think the reason is that there's been a cultural change in what an acceptable body size is. And other evidence supports this as well.
So in a sense, you're saying, well, how do we explain this? Here are some potential explanations. You're saying in a way that it's all of that. It's some of all of that.
Oh, well, there's evidence for all of those, yes. It's multifactorial. In our particular paper that you're alluding to, we found evidence both for the behavioral and the normative mechanisms of spread.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were going to ask this question, if we would like to promote healthy behavior in individuals.
Yes.
And in addition to sensible eating,
yes,
we might also like to say to them, you know, you'd be better off if you got some regular exercise, you didn't smoke, you know,
yes,
the standard.
The usual stuff, yes.
The usual stuff. Knowing this,
yes,
if one wanted to influence people's behavior in a positive direction, how would you do that?
Yeah, so some of these ideas, some of the follow-on public health implications are, again, fairly obvious. Others are more subtle and complicated. Mm-hmm. The obvious ones are that groups, well, the big idea, one of the big ideas about human social networks is that they magnify whatever they are seeded with. In fact, some new work we've done on the genetics of social networks and on the evolutionary origin of social networks, that is some work that we've done on trying to understand why do we make networks in the first place. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to back up for a moment, ask yourself this question. Why do we have friends? I mean, it's really unusual. We're unusual as a species on the planet that we form long-term non-reproductive unions to other members of our species. We don't just have reproductive partners. We don't just have kin that we inherit. We form friendships. And these are a very distinctive phenomenon. And we believe one of the reasons, James Fowler, my co-author, and I believe one of the reasons we form friendships is precisely so as to assemble ourselves into these networks, which networks then have a variety of implications for our fitness as a species. Now, you asked, what does it mean? What does an understanding of networks mean, for instance, from public health interventions? Now, some of the stuff is very obvious. For instance, if you think about things like Alcoholics Anonymous or Weight Watchers, those are artificial social networks. What you do is you bring together a group of people united around a common goal, and you take advantage of this magnification property of networks, that networks reinforce whatever they are seeded with. Other ideas would be to recognize the importance of peer effects in a variety of settings. So, for instance, you said, well, how do we get people to quit smoking? Well, let's say you had $100 to get 10 people to quit smoking. One strategy, the conventional strategy, is you bring the people in one at a time and you spend $10 on each of them. Let's say 10 of them are smokers. In this situation, perhaps you would get one of the 10 to quit smoking by this simple intervention. But let's say instead you brought the same 10 people in. You brought them all in at once into a group and you spend your $100 all together on the group right now. Maybe 3 of the 10 might quit smoking. So the same money spent on the same people with a network-based intervention might give you a much bigger return on investment, a much bigger bang for your buck. You might get more people to quit. So then you can begin to think about, and if you want, we can go into all kinds of additional ways that you could take advantage of an understanding of networks and an understanding of social contagion to begin to devise public health interventions that are more effective and more efficient.
Let me take the opportunity here to introduce a guest, if you maybe have just tuned in. We're talking this morning with Nicholas Christakis. He is an internist. He's a medical doctor. He is also a social scientist who is interested in social factors that affect health. He's a professor of medical sociology at Harvard. He's also a professor at the Harvard Med School and is here giving a talk. He's actually here to give a talk yesterday, sponsored by the psychology department, about this research that he's been doing now for a number of years. And as I mentioned at the beginning, if you'd like to read about this, you might take a look at a book which he co-authored with James Fowler, which is entitled Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. Being a sociologist, you're interested in behaviors of groups of people. And I could see if you were a political sociologist, you'd be interested in how groups do things politically, why people vote the way they do, why people ally in certain ways, why we have things like Tahrir Square, you know, all sorts of things like that. And though being a medical doctor, you're also interested in health issues, why people get sick, and how you could help them behave in a way that would make it more likely that they'd be healthy. If you look at those two sorts of things, though, do, say, groups, when they're doing political things, do the rules that explain how that works, is that really different from things like, you know, why it is that people engage in behaviors that are not healthy for them? Are the rules different in the two situations?
That's a good question. I mean, as near as we can tell, the kinds of rules that we are able to abstract about connection and contagion in human social networks are very general and seem to apply across a diverse set of phenomena. So with respect to voting, with respect to health behaviors, with respect to ideas, with respect to emotions, with respect to economic behaviors, there seems to be a way in which we humans assemble ourselves into these networks. And as a result of this, a diverse set of our behaviors come to be affected by this. So just to be clear, there are two broad categories. When you think about networks, there are two broad categories of phenomena that are important to understand and to explain. One has to do with our pattern of ties among each other. How are we connected? What's the structure of the human superorganism? What's the structure of this beast that we create when we assemble ourselves into a network? And second, there is the topic of contagion. How do things flow through this beast? How does it operate? So it's the sort of the anatomy and the physiology of the human superorganism, or the structure and the function of it. So we can think about connection and contagion as two different types of phenomena that relate that are important when we begin to think about human social networks. And so given that high level of abstraction, then you can begin to think about all kinds of subsidiary phenomena within them. So voting and health, for example, are similar in the extent to which they take advantage of these very fundamental aspects of our humanity.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that there are people who are interested in this because they're interested in the question of prediction, in the sense that they'd say, if we had a group of people and we got as much information as we possibly could about them, but they were talking about what they were doing, what they were reading, mm-hmm. what they were tweeting one another, what they got on their Facebook pages, mm-hmm. you know, everything you possibly could, and you crunched all that.
Yes.
Could you then predict what these people would do? So that's in a sense a political question for a political sociologist. But are you interested in the same thing when it comes to the kind of things that you're interested in?
Well, it turns out we've actually done some work on this. So let me kind of call up a visual image in the listener's mind. So imagine you have a graph, and on the x-axis is time, and on the y-axis is the fraction of people that have a germ, or the fraction of people that have adopted a product or that have expressed an idea, and it goes from 0 to 100%. Most people, or many of your listeners, will be familiar with the idea that the typical graph of this kind has an S shape. at the beginning, you have very few adopters of the idea or the germ. Very few people are infected. And then at some point, you get a tipping point and the epidemic takes off and you get the rapid ascent of the epidemic and you get a vertical ascent. And then as you get towards the top, as you get near all the people have been affected, it begins to level off and you get this kind of flat portion of the curve. So as you get to 90% of people have the germ or the idea, then it's harder and harder to find unaffected people. And you can only go from 90 to 96 to 97 and you get flat again. So you get this S-shaped curve. Well, if you can map a social network, if you can imagine now things flowing through a network, imagine, for instance, a network of water pumping stations that are moving through a large city and a germ has been suddenly introduced somewhere. Most people should have the intuition that a central pumping station is going to be more likely to encounter this germ sooner after its infection, its introduction, than a very peripheral pumping station. Mm-hmm. Because a central pumping station is being connected from all sides. So the intuition here is that central nodes in a network acquire things earlier and are more likely to acquire it than peripheral nodes. Well, you can combine these two ideas and realize that the diffusion of innovation curve, that little S-shaped curve we just discussed, is shifted to the left amongst central individuals compared to random individuals. Or put another way, the epidemic of whatever it is that's spreading reaches central people first. The epidemic peaks in central people first compared to random people. Mm-hmm. Someone who's in the thick of it, someone who's in the middle of a network, is more likely to be infected by a germ and is more likely to hear a piece of news sooner than other people who are more peripheral in the network. So what this means is that if you can map networks, you have a whole new way of forecasting epidemics, epidemics of germs, epidemics of ideas. If you can map the Twitter sphere, like you were saying, and all these little people talking to each other about their ideas and so forth, they participate and create this larger network. If you map that network and find the central people in the network, the ideas that they express typically spread out to affect others sooner. So if you can identify central people, you're able to forecast the adoption of this idea in the future. You can also map networks of people, for instance, that are adopting new farming techniques, or people in the developing world or in the developed world, or people with respect to germs. And when you do this, you can have this completely new way of forecasting epidemics.
Yeah, that's right. It also leads to this interesting observation that if you ask the question, well, in the social network, where would you like to be?
Oh, yeah.
It sort of depends on what it is you're
talking about.
That's
exactly right. That's exactly
right.
Whether
you're talking about a germ or you're talking about a piece of information.
That's exactly right. So, for example, if you if people often ask me, what's the best place to be in a network? And I give the unsatisfying answer of it depends. For instance, if a sexually transmitted disease is coursing through a sexual network, the best place to be is not having sex with anyone, to be disconnected from the network. On the other hand, if you've lost your job and information about where to find a job is coursing through the network, being disconnected from other people is terrible. You can't find a new job. You actually want to have many connections. So it depends. What kind of network structure to have around you, which is optimal, depends on what we're talking about. Yeah.
We have a caller. We would welcome others. 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. This is someone listening in Indiana on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, a couple of things popped in my mind, whether they're germane or not, I really don't know. But one, I'd like for you to talk about the statistics, the mathematics of this, what correlations you're using to make statements that are more or less claimed to be factual. And secondly, I wonder if your way of looking at things would explain in any way whatsoever the Holocaust in Germany. Thanks.
So those are both excellent questions. The way in which we're able to make causal claims based on our data is twofold. First, like any kind of research that uses observational data, you have to be careful to not conflate or confuse correlation with causation. And there are elaborate and complex statistical tools that tens of thousands of scientists use in order to do this. So, for instance, everyone from astronomers to geologists to paleontologists to social scientists who don't have the luxury of experimenting. Astronomers can't experiment with stars, but they nevertheless use mathematical models. And so so we use mathematical models that summarize what's happening in the world in order to understand the extent to which there is causation and not just correlation. In addition, we do experiments. One of my favorite experiments that we've done is an experiment in which we took 240 college students who were strangers to each other, and we randomly assigned them into groups to play a game with each other in which they can contribute to a common cause. So four of us would be randomly assigned to play this game and where we could contribute to a common cause. If I make a contribution, everyone benefits, but I pay a price. And then a bell would ring and I would be randomly assigned to play with new people. And then a bell would ring and I would be randomly assigned to play with still new people. And if you take all these data where people are randomly assigned to be playing with each other, this experimental data, you can create an experimental network. And you can see the extent to which if Bob is kind to Susie, then Susie is kind to John, and then John is kind to Tom. You can see pay it forward happening in the network. You can see how kindness and altruism spread in the network in this experiment that we did. And this experiment was an experiment. There was no possibility of confounding or other kinds of superfluous factors explaining the extent to which altruism was spreading in the network. We've done a number of experiments like that, which help us have more confidence that these interpersonal effects that we are discerning are causal. Your second question had to do with the Holocaust. That's a fantastic question. I already mentioned earlier that networks have this property of magnifying whatever they are seeded with. So networks are agnostic. They don't give rise to the phenomena on their own. Networks will magnify germs. They will magnify drug use. They will magnify violence. They will magnify fascism. They will magnify anything. So, but equally, they will magnify, as I've just said, altruism or happiness or kindness or affection or all kinds of good things. In fact, we believe that the reason human beings form networks is that the benefits of a connected life outweigh the costs. In fact, the reason we humans make networks is that although they magnify bad things, they also magnify good things, and that on balance, this is good for our species. So something like the Holocaust can be seen as reflecting, to some extent, a network phenomenon, because as people adopt these fascistic beliefs or other kinds of despicable beliefs, they reinforce each other and it spreads through the network, just like good ideas spread. And so the point here to understand is that networks are agnostic, they will magnify good and bad things, and they play a role in all kinds of social phenomena.
In this hour of focus, we're talking with Nicholas Christakis. He's professor of sociology and medicine at Harvard, and he is visiting the campus talking about some of the work that he's done on social networks, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn offers programs designed to support residents' health and independence and to help them feel secure in their environment. More information is available at 384-0100.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings. We have 10 topics for you each week. In the second hour today, we will be talking with Mizell Stewart. He is editor of the Evansville Courier and Press newspaper in Evansville, Indiana. And we will talk some about current issues in journalism, particularly how it is that organizations like newspapers are trying to survive in a very changed media landscape. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Jeffrey Sachs. He's professor of health policy and management at Columbia University, where he is also director of the Earth Institute. And we'll talk about his recent book, The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. As I say, we're here weekday mornings 10 to noon. We have 10 different topics. You can check on the schedule or listen to past programs by going to our website. That is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, the guest is Nicholas Christakis. He's an internist. He's a medical doctor. He's also a social scientist, and he's interested in social factors that affect health. He is the co-author of a book that's titled Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives, published by Little Brown. It was published in 2009. And if you'd like to read some more on this subject, you might look at that book. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You've mentioned a couple of times talked about this question. Why is it that humans should form these social networks? Because it seems to be pretty clear that of the animals, we're the ones that form these bonds and relationships and with networks with other individuals that are not genetically related to us. And it seems actually pretty clear when you don't have to think about it very much before you think, well, people do better if they band together than if they're all alone. Even though there are some downsides, as you say, is, well, you know, it's more likely that, say, you're going to get sick if you're hanging out with a bunch of people. But for other reasons, it's really to your advantage to be part of the group. So, and that would argue for that kind of thing having been established over time. If that's a survival benefit, people who hang in groups are going to do better than people who are all alone. But you also, you're interested in this question. Well, you know, how deeply seated in us is this this tendency? And is it something that might even be encoded genetically?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I think one of the interesting things is not to presume the obvious. I mean, we all are accustomed to the notion that we have friends, but as you've been mentioning, it's rather unusual compared to other species that we form these long-term non-reproductive unions. We don't just look for sexual partners; we look for friendship partners in our world and in our lives. And these friends are really important to our experience. Now, why do we make friends? It is to some extent, as you suggest, an adaptive strategy. People living in groups do better than isolated individuals. But you have to realize two further things. First of all, not all animals do that. Not all animals live in groups. And second, we don't just live in groups. We live in networks. It's not like we're a pack of wolves who just run together. We have specific, identifiable relationships of particular kinds with particular people over a long term. And it's not just jumbling together. So anyone who knows, anyone you know who's had the experience of the difference between forming a sports team with your friends and playing a game versus having 10 random people put together, you have a different experience when it's the particular, even though they're both groups of 10 people or 11 people in the case of soccer, they're actually, you know, it's different when they're your friends and you have specific relationships with them. Now, we've done a lot of work or begun to do a lot of work, James Fowler, my colleague and I, looking at some of the evolutionary origins of this phenomenon, some of the genetic bases of these phenomena, and we find some interesting things. For instance, we find that the people's inclination to have friends is partially heritable. So about 46% of the variation in how many friends people have can be ascribed to their genes. Now, this is not too surprising because most of your listeners know that some of us are born shy and some of us are born gregarious. People vary in their taste for friendship, and that might be some to some extent encoded within us, just like other traits we might have, our eye color or our height, for example, isn't incredible. But we also find more bizarre things. For instance, we find that if you have three people in a room, let's say Tom, Dick, and Harry, the likelihood that Dick will be friends with Harry depends not just on Dick's genes or on Harry's genes, but on Tom's genes. So whether Dick knows Harry depends on the genetic constitution of some third person that's outside that party. How can that be? How is it the case that something like this could happen? Well, we think that the reason is that Tom might be more likely to introduce his friends to each other. People vary in the extent to which they knit the network around them together. Some of us have many friends. Some of us have few friends. Some of us introduce all our friends to each other. Some of us do not. And as a result of these traits and others, we come to assemble ourselves into this very specific, ornate structure known as human social networks. And we proceed to live out our lives embedded in a particular spot in the network. To go back to the idea earlier, we talked about the Christmas tree lights emulating a network. If you spread them out on the floor and every light bulb is a person and the wires represent connections between the people, each person is a particular light bulb in this mess. And you might be in one location or another, and you, by and large, live out your life in this location. So just like we think about people who live out their lives in particular locations in physical space, you grew up and you were born in Champaign-Urbana and you live your life in Champaign-Urbana, or you move to another location, for example, but you're in any case affected by where you are in physical space, the same kind of thing can happen in network space, where if you imagine human social networks as this kind of vast fabric of humanity, I'm connected to you and you to others on out endlessly into the distance, each of us is in a particular spot in this fabric. And that location that we have has implications for our lives.
Fascinating. We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Line one, Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Whenever I want to put my hands on an article that's interesting that I read recently, I can't find it. And that's true of something that was in a University of Illinois, maybe Alumni Magazine. It's about violence as a public health issue.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the work of this researcher is mm-hmm. going to be on frontline in 2012, I read.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that he might be at the University of Illinois in Chicago, but I'm not positive about that. But I thought it was really interesting that he and his team are having success in interrupting violence and preventing it and treating it as a, well, as you describe it, as a communicable disease. And do you know anything about this work?
Yes, it's terrific work. Work exactly as you describe. You've given an excellent summary, and the idea here is that violence can be seen as a communicable disease. It's contagious, and that if you can inoculate a kind of frontier of people around where the violence has started, you can prevent its spread. These kinds of epidemics of violence or these violence cascades are something we also talk about in our book, Connected, where we talk about, for instance, vendettas, you know, that have occurred, in many parts of the world for a very long time, where, you know, if I kill someone in your family, then you have to reciprocate and kill someone in my family, and then someone else gets killed. Oops, you kill someone by accident. Now their family gets involved, and you have this kind of cascade of violence in the system. And what this individual that you're alluding to, whose name I'm blocking on right now, has done is he's created a team of people from the relevant communities who act as violence interrupters. So if someone is shot but doesn't die, or even if the person dies, they try to intervene with the family members. They try to go and reduce the probability of retaliation to interrupt these cascades of violence. It's actually very nice work.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. That's 4 Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So that one is for anyone. If you can hear us, you can use that number. And then we do have the email as well. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that this work is really fascinating. And I find myself thinking about the very last thing that you were talking about before we went to the caller about the fact that people end up, for a variety of reasons maybe we can understand, in certain places in the great social mm-hmm. fabric, which will, you know, could have a great dramatic impact on their lives and how they live their lives mm-hmm. and who they know, and that may indeed be something that ends up being determined fairly early that would set the course of that person's life.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really so inevitable?
Well, no. I mean, it's very important to say, I mean, whenever one begins to talk about the sort of genetic origins of human behaviors, some people immediately get afraid. They mm-hmm. think that this is not something we want to countenance. Others get confused. Still others take objection. They don't want to believe that there's any role of genes in human behaviors. I think all of these positions are extreme and nonsensical. I think that it is human behaviors are partially determined by our biology and partially determined by our sociology. I think there are biological and genetic and cultural determinants of human behavior, and I don't think that genes are determinative. So I'm not a genetic determinist. I don't think that, you know, what happens to your life is written in your genes and not malleable, you know, is permanent and fixed. But I think it's equally ignorant to believe that genes play no role in the way we interact with others, whether it has to do with psychological traits or other kinds of things that we've been discussing today. So I think what I would say is that it's where you are in this network partially, as I said, depends on your genetic heritage, not fully. And to the extent that it does partially depend on that, yes, it can affect your life. Just like if you're born, for instance, with genes that give you diabetes, it can affect your life or that increase your risk of diabetes. Similarly, if you're born with a genetic constitution that makes you very antisocial and you never have any friends and you never interact with anybody, you become a hermit and you live in a cave in the mountains, you're not going to get a sexually transmitted disease. You're just not. I think that would be the extreme and simplest case illustrating the point. Mm. So I think that people's destinies are tied up to chance events, People lose their jobs. Family members get sick. There are plant closings. There's a recession. There are all these things that are outside people's control that devastate their lives. People's outcomes are tied up with idiosyncrasies in how they were born and raised, where they happen to be born, who their parents happen to be, what their parents were doing or smoking or eating while they were in utero, all of these things, which are also beyond their control, which affect them. And people are born and raised or born with a certain profile of genes, which affect them as well. And all of those things are things that are outside the individual's control. Of course, there are many things that are in the individual's control. You know, you can wake up in the morning, decide to be friendlier and make an effort to have more friends. So it's complicated. I mean, there are all these things that affect our lives, some of which affect us and some of which we can control and some of which we cannot. So one of the things that many people who have looked at our work have said is that that our work delivers a whack to free will. That what our work does is it subverts, in some sense, the importance of free will. Because what our work shows to some extent is that you're not the only master of your own destiny. That even deeply personal things like who you vote for or what your body size is or whether you're happy or sad can be affected by the people to whom you're directly and even indirectly connected. Your body size or your happiness may depend on these strangers that you don't even know. And our work, I think, does show this. And to that extent, our work can be seen as subverting the importance of free will in people's lives. But the irony is that our work, even while it's doing that, also elevates the importance of free will. Because our work also shows that if you make a positive change in your life, it doesn't just affect and benefit you. It affects and benefits your friends and family and others. Dozens, sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of other people can be affected, as we've shown in our work, by these ripple effects that spread out from you. So even while we are showing that you are affected by others, we also show that you affect others, thereby increasing the reasons that you should have to be the master of your own destiny.
Yeah, I think that that's very interesting. It makes me wonder whether a message like that, while we're trying to get people to, you know, people know what's good for them, but they don't do it. So we're trying to get people to do the things that they already know are good. If you incorporate into that a message that says, by doing what's good for you, this is not only just good for you.
That's right.
But it's good for
people you care about.
Your friends, your family, your community. There's this way in which these positive behaviors can spread.
Yeah,
can you get that message in there?
But people do this all the time. You give an older person a choice of two different chemotherapeutic regimens for his prostate cancer. And you tell him that one regimen will require his wife to drive him to the hospital every week and that he'll be vomiting a lot. And the other regimen doesn't have those side effects. Even if the second regimen offers him a lesser chance of cure, he might pick it because he says, my wife is old and frail. I don't want to impose this hardship on her. He takes into account the spillover effects, the cascade effects of what happens to him. People care about what happens to those to whom they are connected. And so actually these ideas are not so far-fetched at all. You might begin to think about how people make different choices when they're aware of how their behaviors affect others. You tell a woman with newborn child that her smoking, which she's had forever, not just harms her now, but harms her baby, makes the baby more likely to get asthma and so forth. It changes her behavior. So in fact, when you can make these types of spillover, these network effects apparent, it can feed back and affect what people do.
Yeah, about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus for anybody who's just tuned in. Let me very quickly reintroduce the guest, Nicholas Christakis. He's a professor of sociology. He's a professor of medical sociology and a professor of medicine at Harvard University and at the Harvard Med School. And we're talking about some of the research that he and a colleague, particularly James Fowler, have been involved in, looking at social networks and how they affect people's lives. Questions are welcome. Someone wants to call real quick, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Going back to something you were talking about before, I have this feeling that a lot of people think that the old nature-nurture debate, this thing about what's more important, genes or environment, is still raging. And it seems to me that it's been settled in the sense that people are saying, yes, your genetic inheritance is profound. Your environment is profound. Both of those things.
That's right.
Both of those things work together. And
in
fact, it may indeed be that your expression of your genetic inheritance may well depend on certain kinds of things being there in the environment, make the difference between does that thing get expressed or does it not.
That's exactly right. So I think that's a false dichotomy, and I think that way of seeing things is thankfully gone from most parts of the scientific community. I mean, it's clearly both. Only the, you know, only the most diehard extremists would believe that it's neither nature nor nurture. It's clearly both. And it's also more, the story is more complicated. If it's both, they interact in complex ways. And there can even be nature via nurture, a more complicated idea, which is that we have, let's say, genes that put us at risk for seeking out certain kinds of environments. So so the environment you are in might, in fact, reflect your choice of being in that environment, which in turn might reflect your genetic constitution. So the story is a complicated story, but it definitely involves both.
Yeah. So if you really you had someone who said, you know, for whatever reason, they said, well, I want to make a dramatic change in my life.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the easiest thing that they could do that would?
Well, if they surround themselves with people who have the traits that they want. So if you're a student, if you're a poor student or you have bad study habits, to the extent that you can hang out with and study with people with better study habits, work, including a randomized controlled or not randomized controlled experiments, but including work that's looked at students who are randomly assigned to have studious roommates, they become more studious. Or at the United States Air Force Academy, cadets that were assigned to have more physically fit squad mates become more physically fit. So so if you can find ways to surround yourself by people who have the target behavior. If you want to learn how to garden, hang out with gardeners. I mean, it's just using the power of social networks in very commonsensical ways. Conversely, if you want to change the world, you should follow Mahatma Gandhi's invocation to be the change you want to see in the world. So act in the way that you think the world should be. This bringing into yourself and showing this type of agency actually cannot help but help foster the kind of change you want and reinforce it in yourself as well.
Yeah. I'm so interested in find all this fascinating, particularly the one of the ideas that social networks have emergent properties that are greater than the sum of the parts.
Yes.
And that the properties emerge according to how it is the people connect.
Yes.
And that it doesn't, and that so the it's not really so much the people, because by connecting the people in different ways, you'll see different sorts of things emerge. So it's not, you know, it's the same group of people. It has something to do with how the connections.
Correct.
Are.
So my favorite example of this are if you consider 100 people and you have 100 people and you connect them in a very particular way with 99 ties, and you form a kind of linear bucket brigade. So you just make a bucket brigade, and a bucket brigade is a simple social network you can have. It's a linear network, and it's very efficient for putting out fires. You transport buckets and water in two different directions, and you can put out a fire better than people who weren't connected. Mm. So this fire putting out ability emerges from the pattern of connections. But you could take the same 100 people and the same number of ties and assemble them into a different type of architecture, which is hard to describe visually, but it looks like a telephone tree, where the old-fashioned thing where the center person calls two people to tell them that the school is closed, and those two people each call two people, and they call in turn two people, and you get this branching pattern. Same people, same number of ties, different property now for the efficient transmission of information. So the idea here is that these properties are not properties of the individuals, but properties of the group, which is connected in a particular way. And I have another example from chemistry if we have time.
Yeah.
Well, the example from chemistry, most of us remember from high school chemistry that we studied graphite and diamond, some pencil leads and diamond rings. Well, they're both made of carbon. But whether you get a graphite, which is soft and dark, or diamond, which is hard and clear, depends on how you connect the carbon atoms together. In both cases, you've got carbon atoms. But when you assemble them one way, you get one set of properties. And when you assemble them another way, you get a different set of properties. And the intellectual ideas here are, first, these properties of softness and darkness and hardness and clearness are not properties of the carbon atoms. They're properties of the collection of carbon atoms. And second, which properties you get depends on how you connect the carbon atoms to each other. And the same thing happens with human beings. You take a group of human beings and you assemble them one way, they're productive and happy. You assemble them a different way, and they're unproductive and unhappy. So the pattern of ties among us can shape our experience.
Just, and we're almost out of time. We have about a minute, and I'm sorry that we suddenly have a caller that we can't take. But you did say earlier, one of the things you said was social networks are agnostic, and so
yes.
They end up producing behavior depending on what they're seeded with, which means that, you know, you can have a group of people and you can have fascism or you can have altruism.
Yes.
And it sort of depends. But how are groups of people, I mean, are they susceptible to being engineered in a deliberate way with the idea that you're going to produce a particular kind of behavior? Or is there something that's beyond control?
Yes. Well, both are true, but it is possible to exploit an understanding of how networks operate in order to intervene in human populations to make them for the better. So, in fact, there are all kinds of commercial applications, public policy and public health applications to these ideas that are being pursued actively both in the private sector and in the public sector at the moment.
And that's, I guess, that in a way that encourages me, but that also frightens me a little bit.
Yes.
Because it's one of these things can be a power that can be used for good
or evil. That's exactly right. Like any technology, that's exactly right. And so I think this opens up a whole other question of how do we legally and ethically regulate these types of technologies? And this is something that we have discussed in our writings.
Well, there we will have to leave it, as we hear at the end of the time. Our guest, Nicholas Christakis, he is professor of sociology, of medical sociology, and of medicine at Harvard University and at the Harvard Med School. And if you would like to read some more about some of this work that he's been involved in, he and his colleague James Fowler, you might want to look at the book Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives, published by Little Brown, came out in 2009. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Pattern of ties among us can shape our experience.
We're almost out of time. We have about a minute, and I'm sorry that we suddenly have a caller that we can't take. But you did say earlier one of the things you said was social networks are agnostic, and so they end up producing behavior depending on what they're seeded with, which means that, you know, you can have a group of people and you can have fascism or you can have altruism.
Yes.
And it sort of depends. But how are groups of people, I mean, are they susceptible to being engineered in a deliberate way with the idea that you're going to produce a particular kind of behavior? Or is there something that's beyond control?
Yes. Well, both are true, but it is possible to exploit an understanding of how networks operate in order to intervene in human populations to make them for the better. So, in fact, there are all kinds of commercial applications, public policy and public health applications to these ideas that are being pursued actively both in the private sector and in the public sector at the moment.
And that's, I guess, that in a way that encourages me, but that also frightens me a little bit.
Yes.
Because it's one of these things can be a power that can be used for good
or evil.
Or evil.
That's exactly right. Like any technology, that's exactly right. And so I think this opens up a whole other question of how do we legally and ethically regulate these types of technologies? And this is something that we have discussed in our writings.
Well, there we will have to leave it, as we hear at the end of the time. Our guest, Nicholas Christakis, he is professor of sociology, of medical sociology, and of medicine at Harvard University and at the Harvard Med School. And if you would like to read some more about some of this work that he's been involved in, he and his colleague James Fowler, you might want to look at the book Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives, published by Little Brown, came out in 2009. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
We will take a break at this point, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets and some news from National Public Radio. Then we will be back with another hour of Focus, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're heading into the second half of the trading day. Soybean and corn futures are down, dragged by renewed worries about the global economy, chilling demand for grain in the fourth quarter, as well as continued active harvest and hedge pressure for the U.S. corn and soybean crops. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat now at 713 and three quarters, now a half, down 1 3/4. March at 728 is down 2 1/4. May at 736 and three quarters is down 1 3/4. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 622.5, down 1 3/4. March at 654 3/4, down 1 3/4. Now 3 3/4, 3.5. You know, it's fluctuating a lot, down 3 1/4. May at 677, down 4. December corn, 637 3/4, down 2 3/4. March, 647, down 4.5. May at 653, down 5. July.